Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Sheila Carter-Jones. Sheila Carter-Jones has a new book of poems out entitled Blackberry Cobbler Song. She is an adjunct professor at Chatham University. She has taught in the Pittsburgh Public Schools and is a fellow of both the Pittsburgh Teachers Institute and the Western Pennsylvania Writing Project. She is a participating writer in the Mad Women in the Attic, a writing program at Carlo University. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, Jan. How are you today?
Good. How are you doing?
Great.
Welcome. I'm excited to hear about the poems from your new book. And so you're going to read from your new book and some new poems, is that right?
That's right.
So go ahead.
Okay, I like to start with some poems that give me a sense of rootedness and identity. The first is called Tired and Going Home. I can see her as I have seen them all, drooped like a wet rag, turned in tight twist, smooth, then hung out to dry, will be used again. Her skin is the deep olive brown mud of the creek, where waters run slow like tired perspiration, rounding down stone stern cheeks. I see her as I have seen them all, lift brown faces to hot blue skies that burn away the day of scrubbing the rich lady's house, never complaining of working too hard, keeping two homes in just one day, for she's a righteous woman padding a coal miner's pay. I see her as I have seen them all, eyes closed in humble ceremony, praying for the day when aching bones simply mean growing old. And in her prayer I hear a near silent song, rising up in many tongues, singing from down deep rhythms about going home. I hear her echo as I have heard all the echoes of yellow, brown, black women, women, yellow, brown, brown, black, blue, black women. I hear them say, someday I'm going down home. Home I thought was Virginia or Alabama, maybe Carolina, Louisiana. But when I see the mud in their skin, Georgia's red dust, I know to the earth they all must return to be used again. The next poem is about the passing of my father as a coal miner with a black lung. It's called Mad Dog Wind. I keep hearing that mad dog wind howl through the valley, scratch at windows of company store houses, and rattle bone chimes long empty of marrow. It is the sound of my father's bedridden beg for air, the sanctified preacher's mouth full of prayer. It must have been the way the wind's cool, wet hands bent the screen door back until it creaked like lungs pressed against 40 years of December ice. A boxcar full of storm is heading this way, with some old hooded coal miner hanging on with arms wrapped around its slick neck and riding low. This wild, nostril-flaring animal hugs the rail close and stirs coal dust over air sacs wrought with black disease. It must have been the way the wind rattled the screen door that makes me hear my father's cough, a slow draw in, then out, the tired breath, his steady release of the pick-and-shovel life, a handover of reins to a machine that lends a steady push, pull of air into cavities being eaten by the creeping darkness of the coal mines. And funny how it all begins to come back to me, the signs that crawled unnoticed in and out of my father's aluminum lunch pail, his gray work pants, the hard hat, boots scuffed and slashed with bituminous cuts, scars that proved the skin of pain was never easy. And funny how until now I hadn't noticed that my father had grown old, not even when he asked months before to buy him a cane, hadn't noticed the knee of his right leg could hardly bend up the back steps, just saw the smile he worked his face so hard to make. Another poem is from kind of my childhood that I really kind of set me on the path of thinking about working outside of being a domestic working woman, which a lot of women did in my hometown. This one is called Jackie Patterson Saved Us. One. The Reverend Mothers and Sisters said, on turning 16, you should believe you are woman enough to clean the rich lady's house, responsible enough to pick up after grown folks who have money enough to afford sloppiness. You are strong enough to heave a 2-gallon pail of water, wring a mop resting on hips enough, and dare not spill a drop. Then on knees enough, wax the floor enough to see the shadow that you are. Two, like a prophet walking on water, call it beginner's luck, maybe just plain fat rat getting over. Whatever it was, Jackie Patterson saved us, like Jesus would have done if we just believed what we were told when we turned 16. It was the way Jackie swaggered from the country squire after her first day. Under her striped cotton dress, she wore 6 pair of panties, all silk and lace, from the rich lady's chest of drawers. And as she shed them in the living room, we oohed and awed and reached for flowers in meadows, in ribbons, in bouquets. And the very next day, Mrs. C. came for her undies, and we all laughed. When Jackie had to hand them over, the pinks, the blues, the violets, and the white ones, so white, not yellow-gray like ours, and the innocence, Jackie claimed when she said she just wanted to try them on. She really did intend to bring them back. And all summer, she was a locked-away queen, so we sneaked Hershey chocolate bars, chips, and grape pop through her window, because we all knew Jackie Patterson saved us.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Sheila Carter-Jones. She's reading from her new book entitled Blackberry Cobbler Song. You have some really great details in those poems, and such a sense of richness of story, you know, in the poem about the father, phrases like, you know, pick and shovel life, a boxcar full of storm. I mean, there's so much feeling in these poems. Can you talk about, you know, what that means to you as a writer to have a sense of family and story in your work?
Well, to have a sense of family, for me, has meant really being able to draw on meaningful moments, even moments that have been secret, and really draw on them in such a way that I can kind of reshape the experience and have it come into a sense of almost like an entity, alive, you know, pushing forward with meaning, and at the same time shifting and changing. But all the while, you know, this reaching back and bringing forward is kind of filling out my body or my images, taking me into the future.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about reshaping, are you talking about in terms of image and detail, or are you talking about emotionally also, or are you shaping into a story different than the actual?
I think in a sense I'm reshaping emotionally, because for me, poetry has really meant you know, finding those places inside that are sometimes painful, you know, not necessarily all the time happy, but at least there and kind of sitting there static. So in a sense, I'm reaching to bring, you know, fullness to something that, you know, has maybe remained static for quite a while, but to bring it into motion so that it can have some kind of meaning. But definitely emotionally, for sure. I'm really tied to the poems and the stories and the people, you know, where I come from.
Yeah, well, that comes through. It really comes through in the poems in a really strong way. There's also a sense of honoring that comes through, you know, honoring the father and his sense of work, and honoring Jackie in the last poem, you know, is that a motivating force also for your writing to, you know, name those who came before, who paved the way for certain things?
That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Particularly the first poem, Tired and Going Home, is actually, in a sense, for me, a prayer for all the women in my hometown who did domestic work. And it's, you know, in a sense, it's honoring them and thanking them for being able to, you know, do that level of kind of time so that I could, you know, move into another time period, in a sense, if the history of you know, African-American women, you know, living in this world. Mm-hmm. But definitely, absolutely true. Absolutely true.
Okay. Could you read some more?
Sure. Well, the next poem I'd like to read about is a little something that used to go on in our small hometown called Running Numbers. Beatrice swears by gin and juice of grapefruit that her Abraham is a child soothsayer who dreams dreams and in the morning calls out numbers that stumble over half-grown teeth in empty spaces of pink gums. Beatrice lifts her head, thankful for this child of God, and sends him before washing, before breakfast, to the numbers man, before she blows stale breath of last night's liquor into his eyes. She writes 215, 524, and 412 on a piece of ripped grocery bag. Each number, 50 cents boxed, 50 cents straight, and folds the ragged edges in crooked half, sends Abraham, half asleep, half running, to the numbers man who collects dreams of poor women, who count the stars by gin and wait for their luck to turn. The next poem is a little experience with school and taking a foreign language, and it's called Learning French. I sat so uneasy in that seventh grade class, my breath one with 19, stretched to high fluorescent bulbs, then fell on dull green walls as Monsieur Crudiac pointed with index finger, and we shouted in one innocent voice, La bouche, le nez et les yeux, and all the body parts rolled round our tongues as Monsieur Crudiac sashayed the aisles, brushed past the girls to squeeze hard Ron's shoulders until he winced. And it would be years before I understood the meaning of French words Monsieur Crudiac taught in the storage room, words that worked the tongue and caused Ron's immune system to break down and flake away like a stale croissant. The hardness was in Ron's voice when I saw him at the corner of Negley and East Liberty Boulevard, out of school for 11 years and his shoulders curled in, his back hunched and lesions on le front, the forehead. Ron said, Mon ami, it's the virus. And at last I understood what the dull green walls had heard, and the R rolled off his tongue, finally perfect like it had to be in that seventh grade class, before Monsieur Crudiac shooed us from the room waving, Au revoir, mes élèves. There will be candy for you tomorrow. Mes élèves, nous aurons des bonbons demain. And we learned to crave the way throaty French words stumbled sweet, then lay wrapped round our tongues. Okay, one other poem called Pittsburgh Color Line. It's from an experience, actually, that I had picking up a neighbor and driving him into the strip district to just drop him off on my way to where I was going. Called 8:30 a.m., Pittsburgh Color Line. Saturday morning, I see the neighbor kid John waiting for the 7D Perrysville Avenue bus. I yell that I'm driving through the wholesale district. He jumps in and pulls headphones from his ears into his lap, and the rap flows on its own to make a static boundary that separates the haves and the have-nots, woven between a shared and peculiar history. We're about to cross the 16th Street Bridge when we see green ketchup pouring down a billboard and advertised as the new blood of America. A Heinz 57 American dream guaranteed to revive a sense of duty to hot dogs and apple pie. Beneath that sweet green dream are the new true blue or Rite of fries linked like soldiers side by side. I say to John, the world is coming to color at last, and it is a good thing that we are people of color. We laugh between the heated rays of sun, thick in this early Pittsburgh morning. John says, all we need now is some soul ketchup. And I ask, what color would that be? He says, black and blue like bruises. I tell him that I too know the pain of color. And sometimes you don't know the hurt is there until you see the mark on your skin, like the lone lake full of Emmett Till's blue-black blood staining the Mississippi landscape.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sheila Carter Jones. She's reading from her new book entitled Blackberry Cobbler Song. I want to say how much I really like the immediacy and the sense of necessity in your work. You know, hearing your poems at one point or another in each poem, I get the feeling that these poems have to be written, which is the best thing about poetry, you know, because you and I have both heard those poems that where you think, why did they write that?
Right.
But with your poems, I always think, yeah, that had to be written. And there's an urgency somewhere in the poem.
That's fabulous. That's actually very encouraging because I was actually speaking with a friend this morning. We were talking about stories that needed to be told. And though even though it might be very painful, still it had to be told. And there were people who were waiting to hear it so that it should not go unsaid, even though, you know, you'd have to push through some pain. And actually, I'm working on a poem now that is very, very painful. But I'm seriously working through some kind of emotions tumbling and really some turmoil inside myself to get through. And I think it's, you know, as you said, things need to be said. People are waiting to hear.
Mm-hmm. They are. I mean, you don't know who they are. You don't know where they are, when they're going to hear them. The writer Maggie Anderson used to talk about that. She used to say when she sat down to write, she would imagine a young woman somewhere who was just waiting to hear every word she said, and she would picture this person, you know, just in her mind, and that helped her to continue to write.
Well, thank you, Jan, because I need that.
Okay. Yeah,
that's really a great point that I can use to, you know, kind of further this voice that I have coming.
Yeah. Well, it's already in the book, and it sounds like there's a lot more coming. So there's an element of courage, you're saying, necessary to write these poems that you're working on. And and how do you, you know, you get through that by imagining someone needs to hear them. And, you know, earlier you were talking about family secrets. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, you talk about, you know, the color line, African-American history. So there's a lot, with a lot of pain around it. So how do you, when you sit down to write, how do you not avoid subjects?
I don't not avoid subjects. even if I put them down and put them to the side for quite a while, I still at least get them out. And I think one of the important things that I just learned actually from Alyssa Ostreicher from the Mad Women's class is that she talked about the two points. First, the job of the poet is to kill the censor and to begin to write the things that are traumatic or painful or really causing some disruption in life. And I started to do that. And I think just having the someone say, it's your job to do this, that it's given me some courage and some direction, in a sense, to be able to, you know, bring these things, emotions, at least to the page. And the other part is, how can I now get the courage to bring them to voice?
So, right. Yeah, it's one thing to write them down, then to show them, then to read them.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
Then to put them on the radio.
That's right.
But you're doing it. Okay, how about some more poems?
Okay, great. I like to read a poem just observing some women in Santa Fe. And actually, I spent a lot of time talking with her. The poem is called Sits as Stone. La Rosa Cortez's voice is sandy quiet, tiwa, moccasin walking rhythm on whispers of feather, a silent song of flowers that sing, breathless, arms stretched wide in the wind. La Rosa's eyes are black without shadow behind high cliff cheekbones that rise as the Sandia Mountains. Even now she is here, but not here. Her spirit is far away and long ago, as she sits on the west side of the plaza, waits on a stone bench with those whose numbers still spin in the lottery. Numbers that tell who can spread their blanket, place wares from mainstreamers to point at, handle, then stream on as La Rosa Cortez sits totem, patient as her people in the slow Santa Fe sunset. I ask her why she waits. She says, it is not my time. And she becomes steel, her body one with her ancestors. She sits as stone in the rainbow of blue-green turquoise, drizzles of silver, and on the other side, mainstreamers slide fingers down sparkles of stillness, stroke corn husk beauty, and sing the silent song of open-mouthed flowers that drink rain. And though some say mainstream people love jewelry made by hands of La Rosa Cortez of Santo Domingo Pueblo, they do not know freedom of wings that push against wind and their rise upward to Father Sky. And they do not understand secrets of red-brown adobe people who carve patterns in rock that reach back and talk in Tiwa tongue to ancestors yet to come. I'd like to read a poem that actually is a draft, but I want to practice it. And it's from the poems that I've been doing in the Mad Women in the Attic. This one is called Urban Myth, Man Man. Daddy Long Legs crawled up the backside of the porcelain tub, stretched its long legs in all 10 directions, like Swamp Man's fingers, spread wide as he reached with two hands to snatch my shoulders backwards, suck me down whole into the quicksand of his lap, fast and unyielding, like the slippery slope of porcelain under Harvest Man's long-legged knees, bent in stiff concentration. What to do? How to move? I sit chiseled on Swamp Man's flesh chair. The back rises, a crazy rhino lost in the sand. Its head pokes my spine with one crust of horn forces. What to do? How to move? Big Daddy LL takes his time, measures the possibility of motion needed to balance weight, no weight. What to do? How to move? Without losing the rhythm of eight legs in concert and tumbling headlong into the spiraling song of the drain. I get caught up in the head meat of Swamp Man's words that spin inside my belly. Feel the gritty horn of rhino jerk, wild and mean, slip slide like bog talk drowns. Big man in the city says, I'm going to tame you. What to do? How to move? How to push the thick weight of two legs away from wide open mouth? All talk, no bite. Another poem I've been working on is called Fly Home. Fly Home. At first, I think it is a robin's egg, fallen too far from the nest. But it is a small rock, hard and unforgiving in its density, like my mother's mind, winding disc round, stuck in a groove and calling me Barbara. Come here, Barbara, she says. And by that name, I go to her, become the flesh and blood of coagulated memories crammed full, jam-packed as bumper-to-bumper traffic. I turn this rock round and feel the smooth, lacerated lumps of tar worn against granite shell, just as a scar shows the place where skin has been split open and pain congealed beneath epidermal. I see that not even this rock is exempt from stain and the fleshy tones that peel, give the possibility of maybe a bird, And maybe my mother will become beak and feathers and free to fly away out of this gray matter. And suddenly too much oxygen in the brain makes me surge, afraid the rock will hatch in my hand. And clear liquid will ooze slow without form, without voice. And I will want to touch the primordial thickness, sticky enough to cling to my mother's bones, become her body. I will want to smell it, take it in on the pumping up of the lungs, wrap myself in its fresh-born warmth, its fledgling breath. And I think for sure my mother will know her own beak, see with beady bird eyes out of this shell of immense dark, leave this nettle nest world, soar with wings through lapis lazuli skies.
It's the writing of Sheila Carter-Jones. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
It's
thank
a pleasure.
You very much.
I want to mention also the name of your book, which is Blackberry Cobbler's Song. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.